This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Calumet region is made up of diverse communities, innovative industries, ecosystems that are very resilient, especially over the passage of time. And so now we're trying to piece all these things together to create an interesting situation that is called the Calumet Heritage Area. And for that, let's turn to the Executive Director of the Calumet Collaborative, Sarah Colder. Sarah, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
I'm glad to be here, Chris. Thank you for inviting me.
I'll take a few minutes, if you will, explain to listeners that may or may not be aware of it. Maybe they've been residents or they've been visitors, where the Calumet heritage really starts in, the region that it encompasses, and why it's now becoming so important. They really have to expand it further with this Calumet National Heritage Area Initiative.
The Calumet National Heritage Area Initiative has been almost a two-decades-long process in building support, getting people engaged, and it was really spearheaded by a nonprofit bi-state organization called the Calumet Heritage Partnership. They, along with their partners at the Field Museum, worked on creating a feasibility study, which is kind of the first step in actually becoming a designated heritage area. The feasibility study is required by the National Park Service to ensure that your idea for a nationally significant heritage area meets all their criteria. The Heritage Area Program actually started with the I&M Canal Heritage Area back in 1984, and that is along the I&M Canal in the state of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
The Calumet Heritage Partnership, along with the partners at the Field Museum, shepherded a feasibility study through the process at the National Park Service. When it came to determining how a all-volunteer nonprofit organization was going to coordinate an extensive and highly sophisticated heritage area as a National Park Service program, they really didn't have a whole lot of staff capacity or time available because they're an all-volunteer organization.
I see.
The Calumet Collaborative, which is who I work for, is also a bi-state nonprofit organization that works to pull together partners across state lines to work on nationally and regionally, most specifically regionally specific and significant projects. So being that the Heritage Partnership has spearheaded and shepherded it as far as they have, we have become partners with them to take it to that next level. So all of the partners and stakeholders that are part of the Advisory Council of the Calumet Collaborative have joined in with those partners at the Calumet Heritage Partnership to forward the Calumet National Heritage Area Initiative.
When you talk about this Calumet Heritage Area, it's very big. We kind of alluded to it at the beginning of our conversation about geographically, at least, but it involves, I guess, among other things, two national parks. We know what the newest one of the two is, which, of course, is the new Indiana Dunes National Park. What's the second, the more established national park, so to speak, that's out there that's all part of this?
Yes. So we like to say that we are bookended by two National Park Service properties. The Pullman National Monument on the Illinois side and to the northwest, and the newly created or newly renamed Indiana Dunes National Park to the east. The Calumet Heritage Area is really kind of made up of both the Calumet watershed as well as the Calumet region workshed, story shed. So while it encompasses a very large portion of geography, it actually is meant to, because there's so many stories and significant events that have happened in this really vast region that can be attributed to the significance and the history and the knowledge and the innovation and the activism that all occurred in the Calumet region.
I understand, too, that a large part of what is encompassed in the area not only includes the national parks, in this case, the two bookends, as you referred to, but also about local parks and trails and how tourism fits in, too. Tell us how that would fit into it as the project goes through.
Calumet Heritage Area isn't a specific place on a map. It's an entire landscape of a of a lived-in landscape. That's how we like to describe it. So all of the parks, all of the trails, all of the small businesses within this geography make a difference to the operation of this heritage area. Partner support is crucial in order to make it successful. So with each park, with each trail, with each small business, coffee shop, or restaurant, all working together, we can shine a light on this region that we believe, I believe, mm-hmm. is incredibly interesting, incredibly unique, and has so many stories to tell that we can not only learn from, but celebrate in the region.
Then you talk, too, about economic development. In particular, you talk about small businesses, coffee shops, whatever they may be. They're all very much a part of this mosaic that makes up the National Heritage Area. What kind of advantages would local businesses be able to get if this National Heritage Area comes to fruition?
Well, a lot of people think of tourism, right, as you have a place to visit, a place to go. And once you go there, you need to have drinks or coffees or beers or whatever for those people traveling there. But we're not necessarily thinking of just the outsiders coming into the region, but the intra-region use of all of the assets in the heritage area. So if you're traveling from Flossmoor to Gary, you'll be hopefully supporting small businesses in Gary. And likewise, if you're traveling from Crown Point to Pullman, you'll have the ability to support small businesses in the Pullman neighborhood. So that's where some of the economic development, or at least one portion of the economic development that we see as a result of the establishment of the heritage area. The second part of economic development we see as part of the heritage area initiative is by shining in the light and by increasing the pride of place for residents, and to have this kind of beginning economic development, it will show how many fantastic communities are located in the Calumet region and why people would want to live, work, or play there, and hopefully lift up these communities as livable communities and increase the tax base by having new residents, by retaining more residents, as well as hopefully by that time having large employers or small employers locate in the region because they want to be part of this, these strong, cohesive communities.
We're talking with Sarah Coulter. She's executive director of the Calumet Collaborative, which is a bi-state organization that includes Indiana as well as Illinois. And one of the things in particular that I understand, Sarah, that's really underway now is the timetable for creating this National Heritage Area for the Calumet region. And I guess it's actually started in, I guess, late last year in 2018, but it's continuing on through much of this year, is it not?
Yes. We have established a coordinating committee with our partners in CHP, so Calumet Collaborative and CHP working together. And we've laid out five different areas that we need to work on together to forward the advancement of this initiative. The first one is programs. How do we establish good programs that will encourage people to come out and visit different sites in the region? Within our programming arm, we are working with the Field Museum and a number of local historical societies, galleries, and museums in the Calumet region to put together a traveling exhibit that will start this year in June 27th in the Pullman Visitor Center. And it's a collaboration between a number of different historical societies, galleries, and other historians putting together an exhibit that will highlight some of the stories of the region. That exhibit will then travel to Gary in December of 2019. After Gary, and it will be at the Gary Public Library. Mm-hmm. After the Gary Public Library, it will move to the Brouwer Museum at Valparaiso University, and then in 2020. And then in 2021, there will be a full 11-month exhibit at the Field Museum. So that's just the programming arm of what we've got going on this year.
Well, that's a lot. That's an awful lot when you think about it. And a very, very coordinated effort, too, because you have not only what's being done there with CHP, but also, too, it's got to get coordinated with all of the other partners that are involved in Gary, in Valparaiso, and in all the other communities that will be along the way.
Absolutely. Another initiative that we're working on is the advocacy portion. Yeah. And this is kind of the key part that is working to actually get the designation through Congress. And it's a little bit tricky, and there's a lot of politics and government speak in this process. But after we have received a letter from the National Park Service saying we've met all their criteria, the next step, and so that's pretty much the green light from the National Park Service. What that means then is that now it's up to Congress to actually designate the Calumet Heritage Area as a national heritage area. That's a little bit trickier. Congress is a little bit tough to work with sometimes, but what we've done is we've created some draft legislation. We've met with our congressional delegation of Congressman Dislofsky and Congresswoman Kelly's office to talk about the draft legislation that we have come up with. And the next step would be to introduce it as a bill. From there, to get that bill passed. And then from there, to have funds allocated to the Calumet Heritage Area.
Well, it sounds like a lot of work, as you say, yet to be done here going into 2019 here. We just started in the year, just a few months in, a lot more that's going to continue on besides all of the great programs where residents and can keep track and learn more in particular about the Calumet heritage, what they see, what they don't see, what's there in the history books, as well as what they get to see in their own eyes, the nature as well. If there is any place that people want to go to find out more information, tell us more about the website that's been established to talk more about it.
Sure. Our website has been established for the Calumet Heritage Area, and the web address is just simply www.calumetheritagearea.org. From that website, you can find out more about our programs. You can find more about the process of becoming a heritage area. You can find out more about who's involved in the project. But more importantly, you will be able to sign up for a newsletter that will give you monthly updates on how we're doing on the other aspects of our work, the management planning, our communications rollout with our identity and branding project for the heritage area, as well as some projects that we hope to fundraise for and reach out to get additional partners involved in the work of establishing a heritage area.
Well, I know that's going to be the very, very important part of all this, too. There's a lot of work that others can help out in, and the partnerships that can be established out there to help us not only stretch the word out, but also stretch the dollars, too, that you have to spend to be able to educate and promote as well, too. And again, that website address is calumetheritagearea.org. And Sarah, thank you very much for spending time to go over this in great detail. With 2019 underway, a lot more work to go done to the year. We hope to be able to check back with you later on, and especially when we get closer to the exhibits that are going out on the Calumet Voices National Stories projects that are going to be going around the region.
Great. Thank you so much for having
Thank
me.
Thank you. We've been talking with Sarah Coulter. She's the Executive Director of Calumet Collaborative about the Calumet National Heritage Area Initiative. These next stories come to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Race was never discussed around me. Nobody in the block would ever talk about this. That's what's so strange about Gary. There were no signs, whites only, blacks only, but it was like there was an iron curtain there that you just didn't penetrate. But in 1968, a Valpo law graduate named Richard Hatcher, a black man, got elected mayor of Gary. And I'll tell you exactly what happened, because it happened on my block, and it happened on every block in Glen Park. Almost immediately after this guy got elected, for sale signs up, there was this huge flood of people that left to flee to Portage, Valparaiso, Merrillville. People were concerned property values would go down. And there was a great fear that pent-up resentment from black people was going to spill forth in terms of violence against whites. What was 100% white area, I would say it was 75% black. My street turned into just a ghetto. I went down there a couple years ago. It's scary. Any house that isn't boarded up are just a mess. They need paint. There's debris in the yard. You might see a car in a front yard all rusted out. Truthfully, I wouldn't get out of my car in my block now. It just looks rough, like something could happen. But in 1968, we moved to Miller Beach. Lily White, Miller Beach. My street now, where I used to live there in Miller, it's 90% black. However, that house in Miller Beach looks better now than when we lived in it. So it isn't necessarily true that if black people move in, they will destroy. Didn't happen in our Miller neighborhood. Why it happened in Glen Park, I don't know. I would like people to understand that it is actually possible for something so wrong to go on with everybody just assuming it's normal. I know you get busy doing other things. I certainly did. I'm guilty of not taking a very active role in change, but listen to the way this situation was handled in Gary, Northwest Indiana. Everything would have been fine in Gary if people would have just calmed down. He got elected and it was like, we don't want to talk, we just want to run.
The newspaper did a whole project looking at race. The executive editor at the time, Eileen Brown, decided to take 1 year to look at race and its impact on Northwest Indiana, looking at all of the institutions, schools, police, politics, transportation, all of those elements. Me being kind of, basic smart elky reporter, said, well, I want to look at the role of that the Post-Tribune played, the role of the newspaper. Not really understanding just where that was going to go, but figuring that if we're going to talk about anything, we should start with talking about us. So I had to go back through actual newspaper archives and databases and LexisNexis searches, and I would count up things like how many times Richard Hatcher was mentioned in the paper. And it was like since he had left office, it was still well over 2,000, approaching 3,000 mentions. It would seem like it was a real fascination. And we had this little, it's like primitive Twitter, basically. It was a column called Quickly, where people could call into to the newspaper, or they could write to the newspaper. People were really just starting to email even at that point. And they would have their little comments. This was based on a project that they had in Atlanta. And usually people would complain about the Falcons or stuff like it was all traffic's bad here. But more often than not, in Northwest Indiana, people would just mention race in those comments. Race, racism, racial. And you could just count up all of those, and it just happened all the time. And there was one incident in particular where Richard Gordon Hatcher was mentioned. He was trying to get some money for his Civil Rights Hall of Fame. And there were a number of comments in Quickly on this. Most of them were negative. Most of them were negative. Shouldn't give him, don't do this, whatever. But a handful of them were positive, supporting him or just supporting the project or the mayor himself, the former mayor. And the way it worked is that those comments that were negative, they ran in all editions of the Post-Tribune, the ones that were in Porter County and Lake County and the suburbs as well as the city. The ones, and they were only a handful, but the handful that were positive and praised the mayor, those were only run in Gary. The Post-Tribune would write articles about how such and such teacher who had taught in Gary at Frable for 20 years was leaving Gary to go to wherever. And it's like, he's just thinking like, why are we writing stories about people leaving the town? How is that helping anything? They were helped creating their own narrative. Everybody's leaving. It's almost like, and are you next? When are you going to leave now? Well, what about you? Where's your house in Merrillville or your house there in the suburbs? And that it actually helped create a drumbeat that helped empty out the city. Their own coverage began to contribute to what was going on in Gary.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. While we're on the subject of the Welcome Project, the co-directors of the Welcome Project, Liz Werfel and Allison Schutte, recently received $100,000 from the National Endowment for the Humanities Digital Projects for the Public Program to expand their project at Valparaiso University. It's called Flight Paths, Mapping Our Changing Neighborhoods, and it's an interactive documentary in the works. Allison was on Regionally Speaking with an update on the Welcome Project in general and more about this new initiative that has gotten federal support. For folks, if you hear the conversations, how did the Welcome Project get started at Valparaiso University and expand to where we are today going into 2019?
We began as a campus project, a story collection project on Valparaiso University's campus in 2009-2010. Liz Werfel, who is Associate Professor of Art and my co-director, She was really interested in starting to capture stories from students that she had worked with in China that were now matriculated over here to take classes, and noticing that there were moments when they felt included and moments when they felt excluded. And generally, the demographics of our student body was changing at the time. And as we began to think about what it would mean to collect stories, we realized that if it was an audio and video collection, documenting a range of student experience, a range of faculty and staff experience about these times when they felt like they belonged or these times they felt like they didn't belong, we could actually use those edited stories to help facilitate conversation about how do we live well together, especially amid increasing diversity. So that's how the project started. And I think it was by 2012 that we had our website up, which is just welcomeproject.valpo.edu. And we post regularly the stories that we edit there. Our practice is to do interviews that are about an hour and a half long, and then edit these 3 to 5 minute stories from them. And we quickly realized that student faculty staff experience was not limited to the boundaries of our campus. And we began to interview residents and think about ourselves as a larger regional collection. I would say that the Flight Paths Initiative, which we see as officially beginning in 2015, mm-hmm. so we're into our third, fourth year now, we were hearing from students that had grown up in Gary about reactions they were receiving from either students or town folk about when people found out they were from Gary, what the different reactions they were getting. At the same time as we started interviewing residents, we were starting to hear about people whose families had grown up in Gary but had left Gary. And we started to hear this larger story that was undergirding both of these experiences. And so when we started poking around, we realized there's a really rich history in the region that we could help document with oral history. So we began to think about what would it mean to interview residents of Northwest Indiana about growing up in Gary and their neighborhood life. If their families stayed, why did they stay? If they left, why did they leave? That larger picture, we realized we wanted to support in more than just an oral history way. So we began to work with our colleague in history, Heath Carter, who has done civil rights in Northwest Indiana, and really think about what is the larger historical story of Gary and Northwest Indiana that these oral histories point to. That includes the civil rights movement, it includes white flight, it includes businesses moving to the suburbs, it includes the automation of the steel mills, and that impact of disinvestment on Gary. And then for us, we're particularly interested in the region and like, how is this still impacting us today? And what kinds of conversations might we have as we revisit our past?
Well, you mentioned it here about the expansion just strictly from people who have lived and grown up in Gary into the areas. Now it's gone now into the, as you mentioned, the white flight issue. So you have residents who have basically moved out of Gary into communities like Merrillville and Highland and Griffith and Hammond, and even people who have maybe have grown up in Hammond. They have some great stories to tell too, and the impact that all of the changes that happened in Northwest Indiana have made on them as well. It's they're probably great conversations you picked up as well over the years, and this project in particular, the flight paths is going to bring up, I would imagine.
Yeah, and we have been encouraged to go west and make sure we collect stories in East Chicago and Hammond,
right?
Which we have felt limited by our few persons that we are, two co-directors, numerous students, and most of our stories have reflected more on the Porter County side or like Gary Merrillville area. So we have some work to do expanding to the west still for sure. And another gap that we have in the project is right now Flight Paths has been a black, white, and white ethnic story. But we're very aware that there's a Hispanic, Latinx history of the region too. And so one of the holes that we know we need to fill is to start collecting those stories as well. And I'm sure going into other cities west of Gary will also help with that.
And I imagine that this next phase, taking advantage of the the project that you've applied for. Maybe we should explain first, what does NEH stand for, and how did you all learn about the digital project that NEH has and the opportunity to apply for a grant that will in turn help you expand the Welcome Project?
So the National Endowment for the Humanities is a federal organization that looks to fund ways that the public can really engage with the humanities in a way that matters to their everyday lives. So we were encouraged to apply for NEH funding by our administrators when we asked them if we could get course release from teaching in order to help spend time on the Welcome Project. And the grants are one way that we can get some funding to buy some course release time. The Digital Projects for the Public was actually a very generative grant. Like, we hadn't necessarily thought about Flight Paths as its own website, but the Digital Projects for the Public is really aimed at creating these digital platforms. So what we are hoping we will have one day is an actual interactive documentary website that will center on a map of Gary and its neighborhoods, as well as the surrounding cities, and that will allow people to encounter the stories from our resident storytellers within historical information about important institutions like St. John's Lutheran Church or their school that they attended or their favorite ice cream shop.
Right.
And also to have a sense of how those individual experiences fit within the larger historical story. Things, practices and policies that were in place, federal policies oftentimes that, for example, subsidized the growth of the suburbs and really impacted cities like Gary. So we want these individual personal stories to be encountered in the larger region story. And we're really grateful for the National Endowments for the Humanities recognizing that Gary's story is actually a national story as well. So it'll be more for, it won't be only for regional residents. It will actually be for Americans generally who are interested in stories of deindustrialization.
That's interesting. When you found out through the NEH that the funds were available and you decided to put the application in to seek a grant, what was the process like? And probably the waiting period was excruciating. Knowing, as we mentioned, that there are a number of dozens of applications that are put in every year to be able to apply for the grant, and they only come down to, what, seven that they choose each year.
Yeah, I think that number changes each year. So yeah. I think this year they might have given money out to more than just seven, but the acceptance rate is pretty low. So the first grant we applied for was actually for the design document, and we didn't get it the first time.
Yeah. Well, I guess you apply and you put in there hoping that you'll get something, and you come up short, but they just keep applying.
Get really good feedback, actually. So once we got the feedback from some of the gaps that we had missed, we went about filling those in, and when we applied again, then we got it on the second round. So the design document was actually the first NEH grant we got for $30,000, and we weren't sure we would get the production grant, which is the one we just got for $100,000. But we're really excited about that. It's the prototyping grant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So now we can move from the sketchboard or mood board we created for what we hope the website looks like to actually creating substantial parts of it so we can give a proof of concept back to the National Endowment for the Humanities.
What kind of help did the folks from NEH give you as you were going through the process? You got a nice letter back when you found out about winning the $100,000 award that many people applied, but very few people had gotten chosen, and they particularly apparently liked what the Welcome Project was offering up this time.
Yeah, so I think in terms of support along the way, there's a program director for every grant. And so that's a person that you can call and talk to. You can send drafts of your application to so you can get some feedback before the actual deadline. So there is that one-on-one help that they give, and they have a sense of the process of what happens on the other end. There's a group of reviewers who are comparing these grants as they come in. For the design document, it was a lot of the historians and the humanities scholars For the prototyping grant, it's the digital media team as well. So
right.
Now you have to have like a really sharp, keen awareness of who's going to build this for you, and not just the people who have the knowledge of the history.
Now that we get into 2019, you have the grant in hand, and you're able to move now into the, as you say, into the next phase, which is the work that's going to be happening on the prototype of the interactive website and the project itself. What's going to happen? What will folks see on welcomeproject.valpo.edu in the weeks and months ahead now?
Well, on the regular website, it will continue to be just the flight paths stories as they're edited.
Mm-hmm.
We will not have something for the public right away. I mean, the prototype, we're actually convening some focus groups, and the first focus group will happen this spring. And we are definitely interested in residents of Northwest Indiana, also professors, instructors at the schools, and some students to help us initially think about what draws people to these kinds of websites. So as we're creating the prototype over the summer, we'll have a sense of what our audience is drawn to, attracted to, looking for. And then by spring of 2020, we'll have some more focus groups that get some exposure to the actual prototype. But none of that will be public yet as we're working out the kinks and the bugs and things like that.
You'll have more people involved. And here again with the focus groups, you'll have a chance to find out more stories that you can get involved in, that in turn will lead to more conversations that you and the students that help out on the project will get to record, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, we're always open for more people to interview. So if anybody's listening today that wants to share their family story or their story about growing up in the region, we're definitely interested in that. We also often will facilitate community conversations around the stories we've created. So Liz Werfel got an Indiana Arts Commission grant about 2 years ago, and we created a 26-minute audio documentary from our resident storytellers that gives a really quick encapsulated history of the region. And we've used that chorus of voices, which you can actually also find on our regular website, to have cross-county conversations about what happens when we hear and revisit the past and the stories of our families. How is that helping us think about where we're at today and who we'd like to be as neighbors today? So sometimes people encounter the stories not just through the website, but through these community conversations as well.
Well, it sounds like 2019 is going to be a very exciting year for the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University, not only with the website itself, but also with all the projects that are going to be going on here as you continue on to this path that you've literally created, the flight paths, to be mm-hmm. sure, as it's called, but certainly the overall path for the Welcome Project to add more conversations in, and in turn we'll be able to present here on Lakeshore Public Radio in the weeks and months ahead.
Yeah, we have a great partnership with Lakeshore Public Media, and we're really grateful for that. We've also really benefited from StoryCorps. They've been helpful on three occasions with helping us collect interviews in the region. So we're really grateful for our partners. And Liz and I certainly could not be doing this on our own. We have colleagues at Valparaiso University. We have colleagues at IUN. We have colleagues at IUPUI. We even have a graphic designer from Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington on our team.
Wow.
So it's a really cooperative, collaborative endeavor. It wouldn't be possible without all of the students that have helped as well.
Well, it's a wonderful thing called the internet that is able to make the connections possible here. It's not only to be able to connect here in Northwest Indiana, but be able to reach out across the country. It sounds like to find the people out there that want to help out, make this project work even more. That's Welcome Project co-director Allison Schutte. It's never been harder to hire long-haul truck drivers, even when companies are making the job more lucrative, less aggravating, and more inclusive. Recently on the Morning Edition, Frank Morris offered up a two-part series on the topic, and Morning Edition co-host Steve Inskeep has this introduction to the first of the series.
Products in your house, parts of every car, parts of almost every building were once transported by truck. And the system that moves all that freight is a fundamental problem. There are not enough drivers. Trucking companies say an acute shortage is causing delays and driving up consumer prices. Frank Morris of our member station KCUR has the first of two stories.
John, we just need you to back this truck up in a straight line, and remember...
On a parking lot in Springfield, Missouri, marked with orange traffic cones, John Bounds is changing career lanes, learning to drive a semi-truck. A mouse click at home in Georgia landed Bounds behind the wheel of this big rig.
I clicked on Wheeltran, and it wasn't a couple days later they called me back, got in touch with me, you know, made it real easy for me to choose this company.
Wheeltrans courted Bounds, 43-year-old meat cutter with zero trucking experience, like a star athlete for a job that starts above $40,000 a year. Because as fellow students like Jesse Dager, 21-year-old from Philadelphia, know, this industry is desperate for drivers.
I like this company a lot, so I'm not going to say I'm not going to be here, but if I wanted to go somewhere else, there's a plethora of places I could go and get a job almost anywhere in the country.
The trucking industry's been short of drivers for decades, but the problem keeps getting worse. A big run-up in shipping demand, baby boomer retirements, and a staggering turnover rate have left trucking companies unable to fill some 60,000 jobs. T.J. O'Connor, president of YRC Freight, says that's forcing them to turn down lucrative business.
Well, I think as an industry, we need to be more creative and resourceful to attract and retain top-notch people that are very safety-focused, that have an interest, and understand what they're getting into.
Of course, money is part of the solution. Some companies are offering signing bonuses, referral bonuses, longevity bonuses, paid time off, retirement plans, and health care. Last year, average trucker income spiked to around $60,000.
Pay has gone up tremendously, and in some cases, you know, you're talking 10-11%.
Laura Fernell is director of talent acquisition for Walmart's huge trucking fleet. They've got 900 openings.
Our first-year drivers with Walmart will average about $87,500 this year.
$87,500 with good benefits. And like some other trucking firms, Walmart's also offering drivers nearly free online college tuition. But Walmart only hires experienced drivers with sterling safety records. Todd Spencer, president of the Owner-Operator Independent Drivers Association, says average driver income slumped for decades before last year's boost.
The only real shortage is it's a pay shortage. So that's the shortage. Even the crappiest job will attract workers and keep them if they pay enough.
Most long-haul truckers don't get a salary or even an hourly wage. They get paid by the mile. It's been that way since the 1930s, partly as an incentive for drivers hauling unrefrigerated food to move it as fast as possible. Drivers liked it. They made more that way. Now, the government enforces strict limits on the amount of time drivers can spend behind the wheel. Many face long delays in traffic and holdups loading and unloading that can eat up much of their driving time, all without pay.
You put in a whole lot of hours for the money you get.
The driver shortage and tight freight markets are making it more expensive for shippers to waste drivers' time. Companies are trying to structure routes to give drivers more predictable pay and schedules. But all that isn't enough to fix the driver shortage. And companies are working hard to broaden the appeal of trucking. From PR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
Trucking companies are also trying to hire more women and younger people to drive their rigs, as we find out from Frank Morris.
On a packed gravel lot near a sprawling truck stop in southwest Iowa, Ellie O'Dare has found a place to park her truck for the night. At 29, she's more than a quarter century younger than the average truck driver, who's 55. She's also part of a transformation in trucking.
This industry needs people that can adapt to the way it's changing, because this industry is changing very rapidly, and it's going to change a lot from where it is right now over the next few years.
O'Dare is a transgender woman. She likes the solitude, loves the constant travel, and embraces the evolving technology of trucking.
I got into it in the most millennial way possible. I was playing too many video games.
A trucking game left her with questions about real-life trucking, which eventually led O'Dare to a recruiter for Wilson Logistics in Springfield, Missouri, where Daryl Wilson is president and CEO.
20 years ago, 25 years ago, if you're training somebody, we look for a good old farm boy, right? And he drove tractors, he drove straight trucks. He came in, we gave him a little training. He went, made a trip or two with another driver, and he was off on his own and was okay.
But that was then. Now the trucking industry is short about 60,000 drivers, a number that could double in 10 years as baby boomers retire. So companies like Wilson's are developing alluring websites and have recruiters working the phones all day long, cajoling prospective employees to sign on. Like many others, Wilson provides free training to new hires like Angela Thornton.
So more women are coming into the field, more diverse population. So it's starting to become more flexible and more welcoming.
Women alone could fix the driver shortage. They now represent only 8% of long-haul drivers. And there are reasons for that. Lots of truckers spend days, sometimes weeks, on the road, sleeping in their trucks, tethered to truck stops for food and restrooms. Thornton says many women are wary of truck stops.
So it's safety concerns, especially if you're a solo female driver. A lot of women are also still raising their families, so they need to be home more.
Safety is the biggest concern women drivers have, according to Ellen Voya, president of the group Women in Trucking.
We work with the truck stops on lighting and fencing and reporting to them truck stops that are not safe.
Voya says some trucking companies are altering routes to get drivers home more frequently and even springing for hotel rooms instead of expecting drivers to sleep in their trucks. She says it's worth it. Her data show that women drivers stay with their companies longer and drive more miles. And since most drivers get paid primarily by the mile, women often make more money than men. Voya says the percentage of women truck drivers has roughly doubled in the last decade.
I think you're going to see the numbers increase dramatically in the next 5 years.
The long-haul trucking industry also wants a chance to hire people right out of high school. Companies are backing a plan to ease federal restrictions and allow 18-year-olds to drive semis across state lines. Meantime, technology is making trucks safer and easier to drive. New ones are increasingly automated. Some don't require shifting. Onboard systems watch the lanes and can even apply the brakes. Technology also plays a big brother role, allowing companies to closely monitor their drivers' schedules. CEO Daryl Wilson says some older veteran drivers chafe at the new safety features and restrictions. He needs drivers who embrace them, like Ellie O'Dare.
She buys into our safety technology, doesn't buck it. She's happy to drive that 58 to 60 mile an hour and get good fuel economy and be safe. And so, yes, I think as technology changes, the folks that it appeals to change and our face changes.
O'Dare figures that autonomous trucks will eventually ease the driver shortage. Though with her gaming skills, she sees a possible job for herself driving several trucks at a time, remotely, video game style. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
And with all those truckers being hired, they have to take their DOT-mandated break somewhere. And when they're traveling through Indiana, NDOT is helping out in that respect with a new Trucks Stop Here program. And recently, when the program got started, we talked with NDOT spokesman Scott Manning about it. Scott, tell us a little bit about what Trucks Park Here system is all about.
Trucks Park Here is a Midwest project, if you will, across eight states in the Midwest region, and Indiana is one component of those. And the larger goal, of course, of the program is to make highway travel safer for motorists and passenger vehicles, and also for truckers themselves by providing real-time information for truck drivers on the availability of safe, secure truck parking as they travel the interstate system here in Indiana and across the Midwest.
And I imagine probably a lot of this has to do with the fact that trucks are such an integral part of the entire transportation system, getting goods and services from one point to another, from either from intermodal links with railroads into individual stores or the cities and the like. So you have to think about the truckers and consider what they have to deal with on the highways, aside from just the general road congestion they have to deal with and the weather, of course. They have to find some places where they can make their legal stops, don't they?
Absolutely. Being able to find safe, secure locations for commercial truck drivers to rest is critically important for the safety of everyone who uses our highway system. And it's something that as technology evolves, becomes that much more important, and it becomes increasingly important for truck drivers to have information to make informed decisions well in advance of stopping at the end of their shifts. Commercial truck drivers are required now by federal law to use electronic driver logs, so they are tracked to the minute down to the second, how long they've been driving and when their shift is required to end. So they don't have a lot of leeway or flexibility in driving an extra 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes to find a parking space. They need to know what the availability is, half hour up to an hour before they're ready to make the stop, so that they can time the end of their shift to reach a location where they do have safe, secure parking available.
And I imagine, too, a lot of this has to do with the driver fatigue, the problems that they face because they have to spend so many hours on the road, and then they have to take themselves off the road as required by the law.
Right. It is a requirement of federal law that these drivers drive a defined shift. And once that shift reaches the end, they are required to stop for a period of time to rest. And that is to ensure the safety of everyone using the highway system. And you mentioned driver fatigue. It is a serious concern from a safety standpoint. A fatigued driver can present just as much of a concern for public safety as an intoxicated driver. In Indiana, there have been about 1,400 reported crashes in the last 3 years where driver fatigue was noted as a factor in a crash involving in a truck-involved crash. So it is a problem, and it's one that we hope to address and curb by, again, providing information to truck drivers well in advance of the end of their shift of where they can find parking that is that's safe, convenient, and readily available.
We're talking with Scott Manning. He's a spokesperson for NDOT based in Indianapolis. And about the Trucks Park Here program, we know that we're going to find this opportunity coming up here on not only on I-65 and I-69 and I-70 here in Indiana. Tell us how the breakout is going to be for the truckers and motorists that will be traveling through by the rest stops on I-65, in particular here in the northern part of the state.
Well, for motorists on I-65, the most visible component of the Trucks Park Here system will be our dynamic message signs that display the real-time information on parking availability. So as drivers use I-65, maybe they're traveling south from Lake County or traveling north from Indianapolis, they will, at periodic intervals along the route, notice dynamic message signs that display the distance to state rest areas along that route, and also a number that will update regularly on the number of signs available or number of spaces available.
Yeah.
So, for example, you may encounter a sign that says, you know, nearest rest area 5 miles, next one 50 miles away, the next one say 90 miles further along in the route, and each one of those will have a number that displays the number of spaces in real time. Once parking is at a threshold, if you will, in a very limited availability, it will advise the driver that there may be only a handful of spaces at a given location. So that, again, gives just an added piece of information to let a driver know that, perhaps the rest area closest to them is low on parking, but there's one maybe 30 to 40 miles further on the route that does have parking available. So that's the most visible component that all motorists will see at the truck parking locations themselves. There is some technology in the truck parking area, some sensors embedded in the pavement, and also some technology that communicates the data back and forth between the sites and our traffic management center that's in place at each of the rest areas. And then there's a significant online component to this system as well, that the information on truck parking availability will be online on NDOT's TrafficWise system. It'll be available on the Trucks Park Here webpage, which is kind of the central clearinghouse for information about the program across the 8-state region. There will also be several apps that are specifically targeted for use in the trucking industry that will also have the information. So it really, the data and how we share it and how the commercial trucking industry will make use of it is really a combination of on-the-road technology, but also digital web and smartphone technology. Mm-hmm. Also,
now, Scott, have you gotten any feedback? Although we know it is very early, the program actually just officially got underway here not long ago. But any feedback, either digitally or on the phone or in person, from people that are involved in this to see how well the Trucks Park Here system is going to work?
Well, the system just went live January 4th, and we're excited to hear the feedback and see how the system works for truckers, what they like about it, what they think could be improved, because ultimately we have a couple of goals long-term for the system. One is to refine it and make sure that it's providing that maximum value, but we also want to expand to some other locations. You know, specific to Northwest Indiana, 65 certainly is a heavy route for truck volume, but so is I-94. So as we refine this system and look for opportunities to expand it, you know, we look at I-94 as a perfect location to, you know, as we build the system out, you know, implement the technology on that route as well. So we are very interested in that feedback. It's very early. But I will say also the trucking industry has been very much involved and has been a partner at the table during the development. So they have really from day one helped to inform the states on what kind of information they need and how it's you know, most beneficial to them to receive it. So we've gotten great collaboration through the development of this program, and we're really hopeful now that it's live and available to all truckers to get even more insights on how to make it better.
Well, Scott, thank you very much for the information, and the best of to everybody at NDOT in working this program through, and we hope you do get the feedback and get to expand it like you'd like to. We certainly would like to see some expansion up here on the highways in northern Indiana as well, too. Appreciate you talking about it today.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Scott Manning is spokesperson for NDOT in the Indianapolis headquarters, talking about the new Trucks Park Here system. It's a multi-state regional effort to try to make interstate travel safer, not only for motorists and small vehicle drivers, but also for truckers, too. It benefits truckers in helping them find a place to be able to get the rest that they need to take. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and hope you'll be with us tomorrow when we'll bring you an update on things here in Northwest Indiana from political activist Ruth Needleman. And we also will have an update as well on the Valpo Next Civic Engagement Project that's underway in Valparaiso.